From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. In a few hours, we'll have those open lines for you with a special hotline for sci-fi and horror movie buffs. So get ready for that. Here's some of the stories of the day first. While it's going to be a little easier, I believe, to smuggle things in from Mexico, dangerous if we're trying to fight terrorism. In a copyrighted story on WorldNet Daily, Jerome Corsi writes, 100 Mexican trucking companies will have unlimited access to U.S. roads to haul international cargo as part of a year-long pilot program. In return, some 100 U.S. trucking companies will be allowed to operate in Mexico, but that will be at a later date. Calling for congressional hearings about this, Teamsters General President Jimmy Hoffa compared the announcement to the Dubai ports debacle, charging President Bush is playing a game of Russian roulette on America's highways. Jerry Corsi on the line with us. Jerry, first of all, welcome back. Secondly, this story is devastating. Is it going to happen? Can it be stopped?
George, great honor to be back with you. It's going to happen. I've been talking with the Department of Transportation now for 2 days. This pilot program has been in the approval process for almost 2 years, and now that the Department of Transportation has fully announced it, it's set to start in 60 days.
Jeez, Jerry. Well, you know, we have been talking, you and I, for the past month or so recently about the push for this North American relationship, this one between Mexico, the United States, possibly bringing Canada into it. Is this another attempt to do that?
I think so, George. I think this is a complete move towards North American integration. We're already in the Security and Prosperity Partnership of North America. I think that's headed towards the North American community, and it's going to end up in a North American union, the same way that Europe evolved to get from a common market to a European union. I think we're headed along the same track.
How easy will it be to smuggle in all kinds of paraphernalia, possibly suitcase nukes?
Well, George, fewer than 10% of all Mexican trucks entering the United States today are inspected. We're not going to be able to inspect more opening up the country. In fact, all routes in the country, not just a 100-mile or so commercial zone, to any Mexican trucks in these 100 companies that are approved, they won't be inspected. Mexican drug cartels have been buying Mexican trucking companies for the last 10 years to launder money and to transport drugs. I think this is extremely dangerous. It's why the Teamsters are upset, the independent owner-operators are upset. We do not have the security procedures either at the border or internally in the United States to police this program.
All right, Jerry, thanks for the update. We'll be talking to you at a later date.
Thank you, George.
Jerry Corsi's full story on WorldNetDaily.com. Pakistan has successfully test-fired a new version of its long-range nuclear-capable missile on Friday, the Shaheen 2 ballistic missile launched from an undisclosed location, has a range of 1,245 miles. The United Kingdom and the United States have held high-level talks on the possibility of putting what they call a Son of Star Wars missile defense system on British soil. Talks at an early stage, the U.S. is thought to favor a site in Eastern Europe. Russia said the system, which will destroy missiles launched at the U.S., will trigger an arms race. The Pentagon has finally abandoned plans for that massive test explosion in the Nevada desert, the first time a mushroom cloud would have been seen near Las Vegas since a nuclear test in the 1960s. The detonation of conventional explosives had been designed to test the effectiveness of weapons against deep underground targets, but critics have expressed concern that dust containing background radiation could be spread into the air. Those plans officially called off. Psychics recruited by the Ministry of Defense in Britain to remote view and locate Osama bin Laden, they ultimately canceled the project. They didn't think it was going to work. They said it was of little value. NASA has worked out a plan to train astronauts to bind, tranquilize unstable crew members, wrap them up in duct tape if possible. All of this because of the apparent breakdown of Lisa Nowak, arrested in Orlando this month on charges that she tried to kill and kidnap a woman she regarded as her rival of another astronaut's affections. In China, a sad story there, a 6-year-old girl was bitten to death by a tiger at a zoo. while posing for a picture with that animal. In a moment, Linda Moulton Howe takes us into two major stories. The first, the disappearance of all these honeybees. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe with us for a couple hours. Next hour, we'll take phone calls with Linda. She heads up earthfiles.com. She's with us with two incredible stories. Hey, Linda, welcome back.
Well, thanks, George. Don't you get the feeling that every morning you open up the newspaper and there's a sense that some other Earth life is in trouble?
Including the honeybees. Take it away.
Yeah. Most people don't realize that honeybees pollinate about one-third of our food supply around the world. Honeybees pollinate apple trees and berry bushes, vegetables, melons, almonds, and many other food sources. Honeybees were originally brought from Europe to the United States in 1620, and periodically since then, there have been occasional die-offs of honeybees, mostly attributed to mites. But according to the scientists, beekeepers, and government agency bee specialists that I've talked to recently, there have never been so many literal empty, deserted honeybee hives as there are now, and no one knows why. The past year in America, at least 22 states have reported honeybee disappearances. Government and science authorities are calling this, and this is their phrase, colony collapse disorder. Beekeepers have reported losses ranging from 60% up to 100% of their bee colonies gone. As winter changes to spring and beekeepers in the colder Northeast can open their hives again, it's expected that there will be many more empty hives. Strangely, honeybees have also been disappearing in huge numbers in Spain and Poland. Adding to the European mystery is that Spain has very large commercial beekeeper operations with at least, some cases, 3 million colonies of honeybees, similar to the United States. But Poland's 400,000 hives are largely raised on individual farms where smaller bee colonies are separated from each other. So if the answer was disease, you would not expect Poland's separated hives to be plagued by large numbers of honeybee disappearances, as in Spain and the United States. The European countries with the largest honeybee populations are France and Italy, and it might be significant that those two countries banned certain pesticides in recent years because beekeepers there became convinced that systemic pesticides were killing off honeybees. So far, neither France nor Italy has yet reported the collapse of any of their honeybee hives. And one scientist who has been studying honeybees at Penn State University for the past 18 years is Marianne Fraser. I asked her how serious she thinks the honeybee disappearances are.
I would say this is certainly the worst die-off that I've seen in my experience working with honeybees. It may be the worst die-off that has ever occurred with honeybees since they've been introduced into the United States in the 1620s. It's characterized by the bees being there in the colonies, quite healthy and strong one day, and then within a week to 2 weeks, the beekeeper goes back, and the bees have disappeared from the colonies. Sometimes a queen and a small number of bees. Oftentimes there's brood, which is the young developing bees. Somehow the bees have just gone, and we assume died outside the hive. There's no evidence that the bees have congregated anywhere, tried to swarm. There's no evidence of that. The bees are just missing. Very unusual kind of situation.
We're talking then about the mysterious disappearance of bees in the millions, and that then must present a problem in doing some kind of autopsy to find out what is happening.
That's right. It is very difficult to find out what's happening. We do have some strong leads about what might be happening, and that has come from beekeepers who we have interviewed at great length and tried to come up with common threads, things that these beekeepers have in common that might explain some of what's happening.
One of those large American beekeepers is David Hackenberg, owner of Hackenberg Apiaries in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Mr. Hackenberg has been raising honeybees for both commercial honey sales and for pollination in Florida and California crops over the past 45 years. He suspects that the culprit in this unprecedented honeybee disappearance is systemic pesticides, poisons designed to stay inside plants and kill off insects that damage crops. Systemic pesticides are not supposed to kill off honeybees, but David Hackenberg explains why he thinks that's the problem.
We moved bees down the East Coast. We moved Alaska bees south in October. And a month later, in early November, we went out to look at some bees. And the first location we found that had disappeared, we had 400 hives of bees in it. In less than 4 weeks, they just disappeared. Empty boxes, no dead bees on the ground, no dead bees anywhere.
So it is really a disappearance more than even a die-off because you don't have bodies.
That's absolutely right. The bees are gone. I mean, they've died someplace, but nobody knows where they are. Whether they flew off a mile or 2 miles or what to die. I mean, we just don't know how far out they're going.
In that first disappearance of all of those bees from your hives, how many bees did you lose?
Those beehives would have had somewhere around 20,000 to 30,000 bees per hive. And, you know, if you take that times roughly 400, you're talking about millions of bees disappearing.
What have you seen disappearing since the fall?
We had 2,900 hives of bees here in October, and we're down to less than 1,000 now. So we've lost 60-some percent of them.
Have you ever had this happen before?
No, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to us. I mean, I've seen a lot of things come down the pike. I've been through mites. I've been through fires. I've been through floods. I've had warehouses burned to the ground. I've had 10 feet of water in my warehouse. And I know what caused that. I know what caused the fire. And I know what caused the problem when we had mites. But the problem here is we don't know. I just shudder to see what things will look like for this time next year. In this case, the thing that's really amazing is that other bees will come in and rob out the honey that's left, and there's few predators. Here in the south, we have a hive beetle that moves in, and we have a wax moth that moves in and starts eating up comb and stuff. The interesting thing about this whole thing is that none of these things happen. The bees do not bother these combs. They literally sit there for weeks, and you know they don't come and try to take honey out of the boxes. The beetles don't bother them. The wax moths don't bother them. So it's just like there's something in there that's repelling everything else.
As if the honey itself that was made by all of the bees that have disappeared is giving off something that other normal predators and bees are staying away from.
There's something in the hive. We're pretty sure the honey's not the problem, because once you air out this hive for a day or so, they will take the honey, and if you air the hive out, the beetles and everything else, the wax moth and everything else will take. So there's some toxic odor, some. Fortunately, some of these colonies still living, and we found this here in Florida, and we beat it back to Penn State with it. And looking, basically thinking we had some new virus problems, but found out that bees were full of a fungus, and we think this fungus is giving off some toxins. Personally, I think the fungus is probably a secondary from something else, poisonous pollen or something that was gathered by the bees.
Dave, what would it mean if there was some kind of contaminated pollen in 22 states?
Well, it actually means that there's probably a big problem out here that's probably a lot wider than most of us want to even think about. There's the possibility that there's some new insecticide or some new something that's being applied to crops or being used that is being transferred into this pollen the bees are gathering and bringing back to the hive that's coming up through the plant. You know, remains to be seen, but it sure appears that way because there are new products out there that are systemic, which means that they, you know, they stay in the plant. So not only staying in the plant, but then it's probably going in the food that we're eating and the animals are eating and everybody else is eating, and really serious ramifications, this thing.
We could be just at the tip of an iceberg here.
Personally, I think that's the case. I've had several people in Washington in the last several months tell me that honeybees are a canary of the human race. Canary, what was used in mines to see whether there's oxygen or not enough oxygen for the miners, and the canary fell over, why it was time to get out. And Penn State has already found that it looks like the immune system has been broken down in these honeybees. If the immune system is broken down, then this stuff's going in our food supply. You know, how much does it take to take out humans? You know, I hate to be pessimistic in this situation, but it just doesn't appear good.
Right, and what happens if all of the honeybees disappear?
Well, first of all, a third of the food supply in the United States, and actually the world, a third of the food supply is directly related to honeybee. Fruits, vegetables, nuts, just a lot of stuff that we eat that we're accustomed to having every day is, you know, the honeybee's directly responsible for it. And then there's probably another 30% of what we consume. The honeybees are indirectly responsible for it. Take the milk you drink. The cows have to have hay. They got to eat clover and alfalfa to produce milk. And if you go back and listen to what Einstein told us, he said if the honeybees disappeared off the face of the earth within 4 years, all life would be gone. And even the wildlife depends on plants pollinated by the honeybees for berries. And so it's not just the humans not going and getting apples and carrots. We're talking about a real big, serious problem.
When you talked with the people in the government and they said that the honeybees were like a canary down in the coal mine, warning if the bird died, then the miners might die. What did the government people say that they thought might be the problem?
We don't know. That was in the preliminary stages, but that's the first time, you know, in my 40-some years of beekeeping that anybody had ever said that to me. I mean, it was something I had never heard before.
And what you mean is our entire food supply, not only in this country, but other parts of the world, could be threatened as the honeybees and other bees are threatened by whatever is killing them.
Yes, that's exactly right. And actually, we're hearing from Europe now that Poland and Spain, they have lost astronomically numbers of bees this past fall. Even with the losses we got now, there's guys that are telling me there's no way that they're going to be able to replace the losses they have this year. So, I mean, if you can't replace the losses you got this year and you have another loss on top of it next year, you're headed down a bad way, that's all.
And especially is it ironic if the culprit is the chemicals in pesticides that have been developed to allow farmers to grow crops and it ends up killing the pollinators.
That's right.
I talk with the acting state apiarist in Pennsylvania's Department of Agriculture. He is Dennis Van Engelsdorp. And I ask him if he expects food shortages this year because of the honeybee crisis and what he thinks worst case might be.
This situation is unique because we're not sure what the underlying cause is.
Would you say that you might have an answer in March?
Then I think we'll be able to rule some things out by March. I would be very surprised right now if there was a very large shortage to meet East Coast needs this year. However, if we can't figure out how to identify this problem or solve this problem, we couldn't sustain a loss like this again. That's what differentiates this loss from past losses like the varroa mite and honeybee trachomite losses, because there's not that number of bees to fill in the void anymore.
And so what is worst case and worst case consequences?
I think that this is a worst case for the beekeepers who experience 80, 90% loss. That's terrible. There was one Pennsylvania beekeeper who spent $15,000 to move his colonies to California for almond, and he's bringing nothing back but dead hives. And that's worst case for him.
And even, George, honeybees brought here from Australia to try to fill in for the disappearing American honeybees have also disappeared.
This is one of the most devastating stories I have heard, Linda,
yes,
in a long, long time.
And when we come back, we're going to move into a whole new era of scientists calling for Noah's Ark.
And then next hour, Linda, we'll open up the phone lines for you. Many people have questions about this incredible story. Some are blaming, is it possible that it's genetically modified foods? Is it possible that companies that want to take the market on seeds might be killing off the bees, so, you know, they're the only provider, for example, of self-pollinating seeds and plants? Who knows what's going on? But this is just devastating.
Yes, it is. And the Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group wrote just a couple of weeks ago, this threatens the pollination industry and production of commercial honey in the United States.
Okay, stick with us. Linda Moulton Howe will be here to finish up the second part of her story, and then next hour she'll be with us. We'll take phone calls as we lead into open lines later on tonight. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Linda Moulton Howe's website, earthfiles.com. And our special guest, Linda Moulton Howe, will be back with Linda in just a moment. We'll have open lines with her next hour as well. Well, many of you have had an opportunity now to sample Coast to Coast Live with Ian Punnett. It is on Saturday nights, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific time. Ian's with us right now. He's got another great show coming up. Hello, Ian.
I'm so glad my wife didn't hear that last bumper. Or she'd be taking off her underwear and throwing it at the radio. Have you seen Tom Jones live?
I have seen Tom Jones on television.
She was one of those.
Was she in her day or in his day?
Oh, man. This was like, you know, a year ago. coming up tomorrow night, you can help me because I haven't been back to the computer, so I don't know that it's confirmed. But with an interesting guest, Dr. Abramson will be back. We've had him on many times on Overdosed America, his book, talking about the pharmaceutical companies and the work that they do to make sure that people take too much of the wrong things or take things they don't even need at all in order to, you know, just sort of feather the bottom line of all of these pharmaceutical companies. And then the first hour guest was sort of an answer to that even before we get there. I thought this was an intriguing idea. It's sick, but a doctor who says that one cure for depression and for other problems, if done right, is something which we think of as a horror, but would be lobotomies.
My gosh, you're thinking about doing that again, huh?
Yeah, the argument is lobotomies are actually, if you do them right, you don't overdo them, you don't. That they could be very helpful.
But if you do them wrong, then what do you have?
Yeah, well, Planet of the Apes, you know, I guess. You get that whole horrible scene that, you know, I still can't get over from when Charlton Heston sees the rest of his crew after the lobotomy. And that's all I could ever think of. But he says, nope. He says lobotomies can make a big difference, and people can function and lead happy lives with them. And he'll make that argument coming up tomorrow night on Coast to Coast Live.
Well, you've got him. And one of the great things about you is I know how involved you get with your guests. So they're going to hook you up and give you a lobotomy tomorrow
yeah,
night.
I'll try it. Yes.
I know how you like to always relate to your subject matter. So,
next week when you call, the phone may ring a little longer. We just don't know yet.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
I look forward to it.
Right.
Say hi to Linda Moulton Howe for me.
All right, my friend. You take care. It's Ian Punnett, Coast to Coast Live, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Saturdays. In most markets, if you don't have it, well, call your program director and say, hey, look, you're running Coast to Coast during the week and with Art Bell on weekends. How about this? And chances are he'll say, good idea. Back in a moment. Imagine just the worst calamity possible hits the planet, and our ability to grow crops is severely diminished because we don't have any more seeds. Somebody forgot to save them. Well, I don't think that's going to be the case anymore. Noah's Ark's seed bunker, Linda Moulton Howe, back with another report. Hi, Linda.
That's right, George. As sad as the honeybee situation is, humans are trying. And this is sort of one of the happy sides of, we'll say, worries about catastrophes, die-outs, and extinctions. And you start with how many plants around the world are there, and there are millions, and at least 3 million seeds from most of the Earth's plants can fit in two rooms that measure about 66 feet by 50 feet. Now, at least that's the current plan for what is being called a frozen Noah's Ark, to be built inside of a cold mountain on the archipelago of Svalbard in Norway, which is up near the North Pole in the Arctic. And construction on this Noah's Ark to save the Earth's plants begins in a couple of weeks. And it's expected to be finished by October of this year.
Okay.
Now, this Noah's Ark for Earth seeds is being paid for by the Norwegian government, and it's in affiliation with the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. It's an office called Global Crop Diversity Trust. Now, the fear is that global warming will keep increasing over this century, turning some farmland into desert, flooding other low grounds, and generally changing the growing seasons, rainfall, and the distribution of insects. And many plants won't be able to survive these rapid changes. And some scientists fear that even the Amazon rainforest might not survive into the next century, as incomprehensible as that might seem here today. And if we lose the diversity of crops that we have now, we could end up seriously depleting this planet's future food and medical supplies, because we get lots and lots of medical chemistries from plants. Now, the Noah's Ark seed vaults will hold samples of all of the food crop varieties in case plant breeders will have to design totally new varieties to survive on this changing planet. And the steady cold temperature of the Svalbard Norway mountain, which is far enough above sea level to remain dry even with rising waters, it could sustain frozen seeds for 200 or more years. And the scientist in charge of creating and sustaining the Noah's Ark seed vault is Carrie Fowler. He has a PhD, he's executive director of the Global Crop Diversity Trust. And earlier this week, I talked with him about the latest United Nations report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It says, in worst case, the average global temperature could increase 11.5 degrees over the next 90 years. I asked Dr. Fowler what he thinks the consequences would be for the plant world if there is that much global warming.
Well, the consequences are almost overwhelming, particularly because the most severe impact of climate change is predicted to occur in regions of the world that are least capable of adjusting, where the poorest people on Earth live. We're going to see variations in temperatures. We're going to see more extreme weather events, disruptions in water supplies. The list is long. Many people might think that having agriculture adapt to climate change is going to be reasonably simple and straightforward, to move a particular variety that's growing in one place up several hundred miles north, just because the temperatures will be about the same some years from now in that new location. That's not going to work. We won't simply take existing varieties and move them to a place where the temperatures are the same as they are now. If we were to do that, we would expose the plant to different seasonality of light at different latitudes, different day lengths, all kinds of things that would trigger biological responses in that variety that really wouldn't work in the new location. There'd be new pests and diseases, new soil, new amounts of rainfall. So all of the characteristics that go into making up a modern wheat or corn variety are really going to have to be juggled around a little bit to produce varieties that farmers can grow under new conditions. It's going to be a major, major challenge.
This Noah's Ark may be vital to perpetuating food and crops and plants on the earth now.
We think it might well be. We will have to breed new varieties of agricultural crops if we expect to even keep pace with current production levels, much less feed a growing world population
that is faced with so much change in the climate.
That's right. And I'll mention one other thing, because one of the ways that climate change will manifest itself is through water. Agriculture today takes about 70% of freshwater supplies, but agriculture competes. It competes with the cities and industry, and there are over 200 major river systems in the world that provide water for agriculture that are flowing through multiple countries. The demands on water supplies are going to increase, possibly increasing conflict over water, and agriculture is going to be squeezed from urban users. So we're also going to have to produce agricultural crops that produce more crop per drop.
And the question is, how many populations of humans are now going to have to be moved over the next 9 decades because of sea level rise, while you're trying also to provide biodiversity in plants that could feed these people who are moving.
Well, that's right. It gives you a bit of a pause if you think, erroneously, I believe, that crops can simply be moved around the world.
Could you explain how you're going to build this Noah's Ark and where exactly?
Svalbard, that's reasonably near the North Pole. It's a part of Norway. It's actually under an international treaty, but Norway has sovereignty. If you fly as far north in Norway as you can fly, you need to get on another jet plane and fly about an hour and a half north of there. So if you're going to trek to the North Pole, this is where you're going first. Once you get there, you'll land in a small village. There are about 1,500 people that live there year-round. It's very much a Norwegian research and government site. Very cold, as you can well imagine, and it's a mountainous area, and the seed vault is going to be built inside the mountain. We're going to tunnel about 120 meters through solid stone to a place in the mountain, which at the moment is about minus 6 Celsius, very, very cold, and there we'll have two rooms, two vaults, 24 meters by 15 each. And this is where we'll store we'll have the capacity to store 3 million seed samples. And each sample would be about 500 seeds. It would be about 500 seeds of a particular variety. And those seeds would be stored in foil packages that are sealed inside boxes. And we'd have the capacity for storing about 3 million such samples, which represent virtually all of the diversity of agricultural crops that can, in fact, be stored as seed. Seed of most agricultural crops can be stored safely alive, kept alive for a long, long time, simply by having the moisture level in the seed reduced to a very low level to reduce biological activity and then freezing them. And if you do this properly, depending on the crop, you can store seed safely for decades, hundreds, and there are even some projections over 1,000 years.
Wow. And how high above sea level would this Noah's Ark be?
Well, it's going to be quite high above sea level, I think 120-something meters. So we've calculated worst-case scenarios for climate change. And if both of the polar ice caps melt, if the ice in Greenland melts, this facility is still going to be many meters above the worst-case scenario where the new sea level would be. And even if global warming takes hold in Svalbard, relatively speaking, this is still going to be a much colder place than most of the rest of the world. We'll still have frozen conditions in the seed vault 200 years from now if our worst-case climate change scenario is true.
When you talk to your colleagues, what do you see as the worst happening?
The worst happening is a melting of the ice caps and significant changes that will cause large social disruptions, particularly in developing countries. We really want to avoid that. And one of the things that the seed vault will do is to provide human beings in the future with the security of knowing that the agricultural options that they need are still intact. We're not saving diversity because it's pretty. This is not a museum or a stamp collection. It's really something that is quite critical. I've been asked the question, well, what would happen if a nuclear bomb dropped straight on the seed vault? And I guess my answer is, well, I don't know. I guess suppose it would depend on how big the bomb was. So there are really no guarantees in the world. They're really just probabilities. And so what we're trying to do is provide as robust a form of insurance as possible. But I wouldn't ever want to say nothing can go wrong, because on Earth, as long as human beings are here, something could go wrong.
And without it, we might end up losing biodiversity of the previous centuries up to this date in the face of total unpredictability of what's going to happen in global climate change.
That's right. And of course, we're still subject to problems of natural disasters and wars and civil strife. I mean, we've lost several important and unique collections in the past few years. The seed collections in Iraq and Afghanistan were destroyed in the chaos around the wars there. We had a typhoon that struck the National Seed Bank in the Philippines this past September, destroying some of the collections there. And when I say that it destroyed some of the seed collections, I'm really saying that it drove them into extinction. these are varieties that will never exist again, just as gone as a dinosaur is. And what we can expect is that it destroyed diversity, traits, perhaps disease resistance, perhaps a nutritional quality, perhaps a taste, perhaps a color of a flower that will never exist again. And this is something we simply cannot continue to allow to happen if we are serious about wanting to remain on Earth ourselves.
And George, the concept of a Noah's Ark to save Earth's life has now also been picked up by other scientists worried about declining amphibians. It was just a couple of weeks ago that scientists met in Atlanta, Georgia, from literally all over the world. And what they want to do is launch a global, what they're calling, amphibian ark. And this is a project with a goal to save thousands of frogs, toads, salamanders, the species of amphibians. And they are threatened now by so many things, fungi and pathogens, increasing UV radiation from thinning ozone, and these rapidly changing habitats in the face of global warming and unknowns. The scientists are as frustrated in the amphibian loss as the apiarists are in the honeybee loss, in trying to find out exactly what is wrong and how can we, the human species, can we do anything about stopping the decline and the increasing extinctions. And when you think about this, that the amphibians were around at the time of the dinosaurs and before, and they survived.
That's right.
Whatever wiped out the dinosaurs.
You know, Linda, it's a great idea, the seed bank. You know, what they probably do is take it a little further and have a male and female human in there and rotate them every year. You never know.
Now, it sounds like we're moving into the non-human entity agenda of collecting material from the Earth for who knows what. But now we are faced with this challenge. Humans are having to do this on our own planet. And it is extremely interesting to note that year after this, 2008, it is officially being declared the year of the frog. And the hope is that these arcs, amphibian arcs now, so we've got a seed ark, now amphibian arcs, and the goal is to have zoos and aquariums and botanical gardens around the planet construct what they're calling biosecure facilities that could preserve at least 500 each of nearly 2,000 endangered amphibian species. So in Svalbard, Norway, near the North Pole, they will begin collecting 500 samples of eventually 3 million seeds to go into those two vault rooms there. And if this year of the frog, if the scientific goals are reached, literally around the planet in both hemispheres, in all of the major cities, that there will be amphibian arcs to try to preserve the amphibians, because this is so ironic to say, the amphibians are not surviving in the wild of the Earth today.
These scientists aren't trying to tell us something, Linda, are they? They don't know something about some catastrophe about to hit us?
I think everybody is worried about the unpredictable consequences of what's happening in global warming. And if that worst case of the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change came true, George, think about this. 11.5 degrees average global temperature rise over the next 90 years.
Huge.
That is a degree, a decade, and we have come from the previous century of 100 years with 1 degree Fahrenheit.
Oh, gosh. When I'm in St. Louis, I'll be on the East Coast, sadly.
It is absolutely full of unknowns, and this, it's very clear to the scientists who are studying the plant life, the insect life, and the animal life.
Well, stick around. We've got one final hour to go with Linda Moulton Howe. We're going to take your phone calls in just a moment.